I'm here in the gardens with Michelangelo, and what I'd like to ask is, how do you define yourself?
Oh, straight in the deep end. That's nice, Paul. I define myself as a gentleman. I think it's a very difficult thing to be a gentleman, because there's a beast in man. I know that. That beast sometimes gets the better of me. And I respect the beast. I don't want to put it in a cage. But you do need to tame the beast, otherwise your life and the people around you, their lives won't be much fun either. So putting the gentle back into manliness is a lifelong challenge, but something I strive towards doing. Whether it's through the music I make, through the clothes I wear, through the way I talk to people and treat people with some sort of respect.
So are you an Australian gentleman coming home? Because, you know, originally not many gentlemen were transported, were they?
Well, I guess my lineage is slightly more mongrel than that. My father's Croatian and my mother's English, and I was born in Australia. So I've always felt a kinship with the continental gentleman. And I think of all the migrants that came out to Australia post-World War II in the 50s and 40s, but a lot in the 50s and 60s to Australia, which was burgeoning so much at that time. And they came with a very different sense of manliness than Australian men had, who, and this is broad generalisations, of course, but there was a gentility and a softness allowed to the European man that I don't think a lot of Australian men at the time allowed themselves. And it's interesting how many people my parents' vintage and or women of my mother's vintage who hooked up with European men, because I could imagine they just seemed like just another species than Australian men, and treated them like they were special, told them they were beautiful, and those sorts of things that I think even some men today can still have a struggle with saying, you know, without, you know, making a woman feel bad when you say it, to actually give a genuine compliment that doesn't require something back from it. So I love to think of, you know, people like my father, you know, out in Australia in their kind of beautiful two-tone black suit, white shirt and a natty tie, you know, getting about, but just actually being called poofters by Australians, you know. But it's quite funny how the sense of manliness can be viewed so differently in different ways. So I guess it's been nice for me growing up with those different perspectives, where I'd say my mother is very much, both my mother and father are complete individuals, and I'd say they're the strongest influence on my arts practice, really, because my mother's a really intelligent, genuinely and naturally eccentric creative person. And I think the English do eccentric like no one else. I love English eccentricity. So it feels like it's quite natural rather than put on. And whenever I arrive in England, I always feel very comfortable here. And so that's interesting. I feel very comfortable in Europe too, and those twin sides. It almost surprises me how comfortable I feel in England, because there is that natural, you know, Australia wanting to break away from the Commonwealth and be its own thing, whereas I come back here and go, oh, I feel really at home here. This is a good place to be.
As we sit here in plastic garden chairs looking at the Royal Pavilion, I'm not sure why you think the English are eccentric.
No, I mean, look at the Royal Pavilion. That's a great... So let's just build this huge thing, mock Turkish castle in the middle of the gardens. Yeah.
So just while we're in the zone of that, we're looking at the Royal Pavilion, and just for the next, say, minute and a half, could I get an architectural review of what you're seeing?
What I'm seeing is actually the palace in which I would like to live. Paul, I feel like a displaced king, you know, but perhaps I did something in my past life where, you know, I didn't rule well and I had to start again with nothing, you know, and become a poverty-stricken artist and work my way up. But I could very comfortably see myself living in the Brighton Pavilion there, and in the palace, and being a just and noble ruler.
Have you been in there?
No.
I feel like I ought to tell you as well that this Indian exterior, everything inside is Chinese.
I love that. It just pure exoticism, which I think when done well is actually gorgeous, because it's childlike. I think on the one hand you could see it and go, oh, it's just reducing cultures, but I think when it's just done with flair, it's quite lovely, because it's creating something outside of our norm. It's being inspired by something we don't understand. I think that's what artists do, I think, all the time. Look at someone like Grieg, I remember when we were kids, we had these records that had all of the Peer Gynt suites, and they had a voiceover telling the story. Peer Gynt was a young man who grew up in Norway, and we'd sit and listen to them, and they just went in and shaped our little minds because these grand adventures. But here was a story about a fellow from Norway going to Arabia and all these things, and they were not based on any realities. And again, artists do this, and sometimes I think it's thought an artist could only possibly write about something if they've experienced it firsthand and gone through it. But I think sometimes, actually, of course, you can create great work that way, but the realms of imagination of knowing something and being inspired by a postcard and then writing a whole book or suite of songs is a wonderful thing. And it can work in all sorts of ways. It can be in that lovely realm of the imagination, or I think back to, I can't think of the name, but you'd know the wonderful song Strange Fruit that was made famous by Billie Holiday and became a really rallying song about the awful murder, basically, of black people in the South being hung from trees. But it was written, I believe, by a Jewish school teacher who saw a picture in the paper. So it wasn't written by... And Billie Holiday, wonderful as she is, and not deriding her, I love her, took credit for having written it for quite a few years because it was so associated with her. But eventually she said, no, I didn't, and kind of came clean. But it was written by someone who saw a picture and it evoked such intensity in them. They wrote this song that it would have been hard for a black person to have written that song at the time for it to be accepted within white culture. So it's very interesting. Mm. I don't know how I got onto that from the Brighton Pavilion.
I don't know, but I'm going to move from the Brighton Pavilion to Edinburgh, just with a question that if you asked, I think, a lot of, I don't know, Middle England English people where they associate cabaret, they will probably say Paris, France, Germany, and so on. And yet, when we're at the Edinburgh Fringe, and certainly this was true a couple of years ago, I remember particularly, I mean, all the circus and all the cabaret was coming from Australia. So just take us back to Australia and tell us how that came about.
It's a really interesting thing that it's been such a huge revolution in Australia. And I'd have to say, without any nepotism at all, that the Spiegel Tent has been a massive part of that, you know. And they're my friends. I've performed with them for over 10 years. But David Bates and the famous Spiegel Tent has allowed a space for artists to play. And just like I was talking about the realms of the imagination before, when you walk into that tent, It for me, even now, even though I've been into it thousands of times, my childlike imagination of what a magical circus tent is, the one you would run away to, is that. It's not, it in fact isn't really a circus tent, but it somehow is that dream image of a tent, you know, that, and I'm not saying the Spiegel Tent alone created that. There's been a worldwide interest in, from nostalgia through to actually reinterpretation in kind of lost arts that you could associate with vaudeville and sideshow and circus. But I think that the Spiegel Tent has really allowed artists to build that. And I mean, whether it's through Le Clique or people putting on their own shows, to have a context in which the work can be seen without... I've sort of lost my thread mid-thought there. I guess what I was trying to say is that so many venues are a little bit... They feel artificial. You know, you're sitting in the seat. You know, it's not actually particularly pretty. Something about the Spiegel Tent is that the actual space itself is working to help create more with your performance. So that's why, to me, it doubles the experience when you're performing in there. So why it's blossomed so much in Australia? Well, I guess the Spiegel Tent. There's been Spiegel Tents over here, but David is from Australia, so he's taken it to Melbourne and Sydney and Adelaide so many times. So it's been a pivotal part of the Adelaide Fringe, as you'd know, and then also a pivotal part of the Edinburgh Fringe, which, as you know, is about 40% population Australians. Yeah. But I don't know why one thing has led to another there. I wish my friend Captain Frodo was here. I don't know if you've ever come across Frodo. He's an amazing Norwegian contortionist and musician and really philosopher. He writes a brilliant blog called About the Way of the Showman. And draws the parallel between the showman and the shaman, you know, in a very interesting way. But he thinks a lot about the nature of circus and elaborates on it. So you should pop a link to his thing because it may have some answers in there. And he elaborates on this sort of thing at great length. Where myself, I feel like a cousin of the circus world who accept me, and I come into their world every now and then because I have some carnival songs, and there's something in some of my performance, particularly with the Black Sea Gentleman, that does evoke some of that lost world of the carnival and the circus. But predominantly I deal in terms of music, and even though some people have used my music as backing music for circus shows, predominantly when I'm performing, it's not as a circus act. You know? I am known to occasionally wear my my strongman trunks. And
but I guess I'm asking also, it seems like there's a two-way highway, because when I'm in Edinburgh, just about everybody I talk to that's starting out in theatre, they dream of going to Adelaide. Mm. And just about everyone from Adelaide I talk to was, you know, dreaming of getting out of Adelaide and coming to Edinburgh.
But don't you think that's the human condition? We always want what we don't have, and it's not quite the grass is greener, but I think everyone's got that to some degree, but artists have that wanderlust in an intense way, and part of it's a wonderful thing about wanting to communicate with people, and it's that unrest that forces us out of our beds, and let's face it, artists can be a depressive bunch, and I don't put myself out of that that category, but as I've grown up as an artist, I've learned my ways to deal with the fact that the world hasn't quite, sometimes the world doesn't shape up to what you want it to be, and I think the sort of temperament and mindset that leads you to becoming, spending your life as an artist is a pretty intense one, and it's a form of madness, I think, but at the same way that making art, and this is not in a simplistic way, it is a form of therapy, not just for the artist, but for audiences, it's because we're sharing emotions and stories with people that allow them to go through all those emotions that can be great and wonderful, but also difficult in an environment that is actually safe. You know, no one's actually going to slit your throat or kind of strangle you, but you can. We're getting away from circus here, but I think that's where I'm interested in both the surface and the mundane in art, which really interests me, but also the profundity that is beneath that. And with the Black Sea Gentleman, you know, when you decide on a band name, well, for me, I didn't know why I liked it, but we knew we all liked it. It somehow was a code for us, but it took me years to realise what it really meant. The same way often when I write a song, I understand a few keys of what's going on there, but part of the reason of keeping singing that song is that I learn more about it as I sing it as well. And with the Black Sea Gentleman, it's like we literally do plumb the depths of the Black Sea. We go down and go through all the mire and the grime and the filth, but we find beautiful things and we celebrate rather than just getting kind of drowning in the muck.
Well, so, Mr. Artist, you know, namesake of the man who painted the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
Where does your next idea come from?
Oh, I'm struck by them all the time. It's actually slightly frustrating. And one of my great, I mean, it's wonderful, but one of my great disciplines I have to keep honing is to allow ideas to just sit and not have to pursue them, because I think if you allow your mind to be open to ideas, they can come to you all the time. And all of them are probably pretty doable and exciting, but what ideas you stick with and which ones you do is an interesting challenge for me. I have multiple projects on the go at any time. I've got about three bands on the go and a project with my partner who's about to arrive in Edinburgh, in Brighton next week, and a few solo projects, and then a bunch of other projects I want to get onto. And that's just with those particular groups that then have projects within them. So at least I am in a realm where ideas are a good thing to have, but I think they just come to me all the time. I think it's about being open to them. I think it's very easy to be too critical of whether it's a good idea or whether you should what you should be thinking at any given time or whether it's good enough. But I think any idea is just full of the seed of something that could be brilliant.
So just as we're sitting opposite a building that the Prince Regent loved but Queen Victoria hated and wanted to get off her hands as soon as possible.
Right?
So I'm going to wear her Victorian hat and life coach here and say, just for the purposes of the conversation, but one idea. Just focus on one idea. You know, dive as deep as you can and do one. Multitasking is fleeing from, you know, the deep dive, isn't it?
No, I like your devil's advocate way, and I sometimes look to myself and go, should I just, you know, cut it all away and just do the one thing? And I think you have to find the way that works for you. And it's an interesting combination between that we're trying to make a living out of this damn thing we do as well, which is and this isn't, you know, crying foul. I wouldn't choose to be living my life any other way. But the difference between the purity of an idea and pursuing it and having to pay the rent is a really interesting thing, you know. And so, like anyone, at any time, you're making all these different compromises, hopefully most of them positive, to what you could be doing. And for example, there's an album I'm going to record in July, but that's contingent on when I find out whether the funding's coming through. But I'm planning all these things around it. It's an album I've written about Melbourne. It's my love song to Melbourne. All these songs that, like ideas, came to me pretty much walking about the streets, because I'm an avid pedestrian, you know, walking the streets, be it at night or in the afternoon on my way somewhere, and tunes coming into my head, and there's this whole body of work, and I want to make something of it. Now, I could say I shouldn't even bother doing that at all, because really I've got enough projects on the go, but I've written it. I've started talking to all these people about it. They're excited about it. It helps me to celebrate the city I live in and the artists I work with to do so. It's a great idea. Anyone I talk to about it likes it, but I don't really need to do it. I mean, I've got enough on the go. So why the bloody hell am I doing it?
I've got a final question for you. just so we can get on with our tea. What will be happening in the Spiegel tent in 5,000 years' time?
I think that'll be about the time when there's the next cabaret resurgence. It will have been out of vogue for about 250 years. But hopefully some of our ancestors... I don't know. What's the opposite to ancestors?
I've got four bears.
We'll be sitting there in the audience going, I wonder why people are interested in this strange antiquated form.
Yeah. But is it going to be, you know, still rooting back to 1930s burlesque, or is it going to be rooting back to whatever 100 years was before the 5,000?
I think that's an interesting call, Paul. I think part of the interest in that era is it kind of was... The whole modern world was striving towards something. It was quite exciting. And in a way, in my mind, World War II kind of really ruined the modernist dream. You know, World War I did fuck it as well. But there was... Art was going through this amazing resurgence. The world was changing so much, and it did feel... you look at painting art movements from the Russian constructivists through to the surrealists and performers. I mean, a lot of people were artists, performers, and so forth. They really felt like they were making a new language for a new world, and I think that's bloody exciting. And then you look at the popular arts of radio and film and everything at the time that were creating these incredible worlds of beauty. Like, there's a reason why it's inspiring. And I think the fact that this is almost coming full circle to what we were talking about at the start. We only have some vestiges of recording from that era in terms of musical recordings, filmic recordings, photos. And so those things that we see match up with our imagination, creating more of the picture. And I think that's why it's been such an inspiration to artists to create inspired by these things, whether it's been purposefully or whether it's happened quite instinctively. And I'd say on my side, it's really happened quite instinctively, writing about, when I was a young man, writing about the circus and the carnival in short stories and in songs. And it seemed like a world where there was another truth that was lying in there, that it could be symbolic of the everyday world in this little hyper-real strange paradise. And that's why, for me, the Spiegel tent fits so well in Brighton, because coming to Brighton and seeing the pier and the whole idea of the little carnival by the sea is really, it feels like it's part of Brighton's identity as an outsider. It may not be as someone who...
I suppose what I was asking behind that, though, is also so much of what I've been seeing in the world of actually circus and cabarets trying to find newness and originality, you know, the new, the genuinely new. But what it's doing is it's doing very wonderful and beautiful original things by mixing the already existing palette of broken pictures from the past. And I'm wondering, 5,000 years from now, are we going to find a new originality, or is it going to burn out trying to constantly refer back somewhere?
Well, wow, that's a great question to... I don't think it needs an answer. I think that's a great question to pose. I ultimately am a positivist and an idealist, hopefully a realist too, and I think that part of human nature is creativity, and so it is a replenishing source that doesn't dry out. So I see relations between what artists are doing now, not just with the 1930s, but back to ancient Greek and beyond there. Like, I feel... even with rhythm in music or I know I'm not speaking seriously just about circus here, but I think that ancient theatre or myth-making, and then here I'm only talking about the history of white culture, has always had all these elements at play in it. And I think circus in the 1930s and vaudeville was picking up on those things too. You look at all the primitive masks and exotic birds and things people were being there. There's always a sense of reference to the natural world. And so as long as we don't actually snuff ourselves out, I think we'll keep making things.
Oh, go on, and one last one. I've just got to answer because it came into my head. Come on, your three desert island discs and your one luxury.
Okay. My one luxury. Is food a luxury?
If you want it to be.
They were saying to me at the Spiegel tent yesterday, you keep eating. I said, well, I like eating. I wasn't hungry this morning, but I got one of these special rock cakes. So, okay, my luxury is food, because I don't necessarily think you'd have food on a desert island. I couldn't only try to climb the tree for coconuts. Desert island discs. You're a bastard, because I like so much different music. And I know... No, I know. I'm just going to squirm a little bit on the... So much is flashing before my eyes here.
We'll just have the silence of the seagulls while this is going on.
Okay. These are probably going to seem like strange choices. I think I'd probably take Nick Cave album, The Boatman's Call, which I really love. I love his melancholy stuff as much as I love his wild stuff. I'm going to go for Tom Waits. I'm just going to go back to albums I loved when I was young. Tom Waits, Frank's Wild Years. And a third one. Who's going to be the lucky third? Something instrumental. No. Nick and Tom will get in there. That's just because I'm just... They're coming to mind. And thirdly, something with no words in it. I'm trying to think. Are other people as bad at this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because as soon as we... I know what it would be. It would be... Am I allowed to make one of them a compilation?
Go on.
That I would make myself? Yes. Okay, so it would be a playlist of my favourite Ennio Morricone spaghetti western themes. Including the really beautiful ones. Probably no vocal ones.
So that was A Fistful of Michelangelo. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.